Okay, so let's start recording the meeting. Welcome to the National Science Foundation SCI's Distinguished Lecture Series. We're just delighted to have Geoffrey Hinton here, who won the Turing Award in 2018 for his work on deep learning and artificial neural networks. The citation is for conceptual and engineering breakthroughs that have made deep neural networks a critical component of learning, but I think a critical component of computing. But beyond just making them a critical component of computing, essentially establishing the whole intellectual foundations of the field and everything it tells us about learning in general. He is an engineering fellow at Google, as well as a vice president and chief scientific advisor of the Vector Institute at University of Toronto. He holds a doctoral degree in artificial intelligence from the University of Edinburgh. His list of awards is pretty staggering. I thought two of the most interesting were Companion of the Order of Canada, Canada's highest honor, and Fellow of the Royal Society in the UK, the society that goes back to the days of Newton. I said he needs little introduction as basically the person, I think, responsible for, I said, shaping the intellectual foundations of artificial neural net approach to machine learning and keeping it alive through through many years where it was not so popular. Just a couple of interesting notes I saw in his biography. He is the great-great-grandson of George Boole, the founder of symbolic logic, and his middle name, Everest, honors his relative, Colonel Sir George Everest, after whom the mountain is named. And so he will now take us to new intellectual peaks. Before he starts, I'll just remind people that at the end of his talk, we'll have a moderated question session. You can type your questions into the Q&A window. So don't type them into the chat window, but use the Q&A window. And I expect there to be quite a flood of questions. So if you see questions that others have asked that you would like to have chosen to be asked, click on the thumbs up and that'll help us sort through them. So with that, Dr. Hinton, please proceed.
Okay, thanks for inviting me to give this talk. I was once funded by NSF, so I owe you guys. Before I start, I'd like to apologize because some people here will know a lot about the technology of neural nets and other people will know less. And I'm gonna go too slow for some people and too fast for other people, which sort of on average should be about right. Oops. I'm trying to figure out how to. I can't advance my talk anymore. Oh, there, okay. I'm gonna be talking about an imaginary system called GLOM. GLOM doesn't exist. GLOM's just a way of talking about my ideas in the context of a system. This system's gonna try and combine a lot of recent ideas in neural networks. So it's gonna combine ideas from transformers, which have had their most success with modeling natural language in something called BERT, but more recently have been very successful in vision. It's gonna use ideas about unsupervised learning of visual representations, that go back to 1992, but started working very well quite recently. And it's gonna learn ideas about using implicit functions in graphics as generative models of images. And I will briefly explain each of those three advances, and then I'll combine them into a system called GLOM. If GLOM ever works, it's gonna do perception in a way that's much more human-like. So I want to start by spending quite a lot of time convincing you about something about human perception. People tend to think that Cartesian frames are a mathematical invention that's kind of useful for doing geometry with, but isn't actually how people work. I actually believe it is how people work, that we impose rectangular coordinate frames on things, and our understanding of objects is entirely relative to these rectangular coordinate frames that we impose. So in order to convince you of that, I'm going to do a demo. It's an old demo. And to get the full benefit of this demo, you actually have to do the task yourself. So I'm going to tell you what to do, and you actually have to do it. Since it's Zoom, nobody can see you getting it wrong. So here's the task. You've got to imagine a wireframe cube resting squarely on a tabletop in front of you. And imagine it about a foot along one side and made of matte black wires. And now imagine, and you can do that, right? Everybody can imagine a cube, a wireframe cube. Now imagine the body diagonal that goes from the front bottom right corner to the top back left corner. So it's sort of through the middle of the cube. Now, this is the bit you actually have to do. You put one hand in front of you, that one finger of your left hand that represents the front bottom right corner. And then there's another finger of the other hand that represents, here we go, that represents the top back left corner. And now what you do is you imagine rotating the cube. So this finger is vertically above that finger. Okay. So now you've got the, what was the top back left, it's vertically above the front bottom right. Okay. Now, taking away the hand that's the bottom corner, that's resting on the tabletop still, you have to point with this finger, with your other finger, you have to point to where the other corners of the cube are. Just put your fingertip in space, in turn, to where the other corners of the cube are. Okay, now you actually have to do that yourself. So I'm gonna force you to point out where you think the other corners are. And then I'll tell you what most people do. The sort of modal response is to say, well, they're here, 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 and here. And the thing is, people point out the four other corners, and then you ask them to count the corners of a cube when it's in normal orientation, and you'll discover there are eight corners. And what people pointed out was just four corners. So what on earth's going on? Well, the fact is, I forced you to use a different coordinate system for the cube by taking that axis and making it vertical. And I said, relative to that coordinate system, where are the corners of the cube? The other corners, because this is defined by two corners. And people simply can't do it. Crystallographers can do it, and a few people do it. But most people say, here, 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 and here, they point out four, or they point out them not quite at the same height, the four, but they normally point out four corners. So one explanation is that when you rotate the cube mentally, the centripetal forces are so great that two of the four corners fly off into your unconscious. But that's not my theory. My theory is that you're using rectangular coordinate frames, and I forced you to use an unusual frame, and you simply don't know where things are relative to that frame. Now, what's interesting is what people point out. They point out these four corners, typically at the same height along this axis. And so what they pointed out is two square-based pyramids stuck base to base. So my top finger and the four corners make one pyramid, my bottom finger and the four other corners make another pyramid. Two square pyramids stuck base to base. That's called an octahedron. It's not a cube, but it's got a very interesting property. It's got the same symmetries as a cube in its normal orientation. That is, if you substitute the corners for faces and faces for corners, a cube turns into an octahedron, and you've managed to then preserve the fourfold rotational symmetry. Because what you really know about cubes, which is obvious in their standard orientation, is they've got this fourfold rotational symmetry, or a pair of bilateral symmetries. And that's, when I give you this cube in this unusual orientation, what you preserve is that. That's the most fundamental thing you know about a cube, and you try and preserve that, even though you've got no idea where the corners are. I'll actually show you a picture now of where the corners actually are. So the colored rods are the edges of the cube that don't connect to your two fingertips. And those, the six corners, and they form a zigzag ring. So I've actually have here with me, if I back up from the camera, I'm not sure I can show it. Yeah, here we go. Here is the cube, and I'm going to rotate it a bit so you can see. Hopefully you can see that. You see that zigzag ring. So I've got a picture of it here. And I want to use this to show you one more thing about human perception. Not only do we use rectangular coordinate frames, but we also parse things. So if you look at those six rods, I've colored them in such a way that you naturally parse them into a green flap, a blue flap, and a red flap. And I'll call this parse of those six rings a crown. It's three flaps that slope upwards and outwards. Okay, that's one way of seeing those six rods. But there's a completely different way of seeing the same six rods. So if I color them differently to encourage that way of seeing it, you can see them, the green flap's the same as before, but now you've got the ends of a blue rectangle and you've got a red flap that slopes downwards and outwards. Previously it was upwards and outwards, but now it's downwards and outwards, which seems like a bit of a puzzle. When you see it like this, you have a completely different internal representation. If you see it like this and I were to take the image away, you would still know that there were two parallel lines there, those two blue lines. When you see it as a green flap sloping up, a red flap sloping down, and a central rectangle, you're very well aware that lines A and D are parallel. You're not aware of any other pairs of parallel lines. And that's because A and D line up with the intrinsic coordinate frame of that central rectangle. Now, if you look at a pair of lines like E and B, they're also parallel, but you're not at all aware of that when you parse it in the way that's colored here. That's because they're in different parts and because they don't line up with the natural coordinate frames of the parts they're in. One other thing about this cube and hexahedron. So a cube in the other orientation I call a hexahedron. It's a cube, but seen a different way. When you see it as a hexahedron, you're not at all aware of any right angles in it. And if I deform it so the right angles come and go, you don't notice when it's a right angle and when it's not. Whereas if I see it as a cube, if I deform it by like 2 degrees, you're acutely aware that it's a deformed cube. In other words, you only notice that things are right angles when they line up with your rectangular coordinate system. If I get you to impose a rectangular coordinate system and the edges don't line up with it, like for that flap EF shown there, the green flap, you're not at all aware of whether an angle's a cube. Like the vertex of that flap, it's actually, a right angle. Your vertex of that EF flap is actually a right angle. You're not aware of that at all because you're seeing it as a triangle. Okay, enough said. So the upshot of all that is, there's a fun demo. It shows that people haven't got a clue where the pieces are if they use a different coordinate frame, and that they use rectangular coordinate frames, and that they parse images, and they can parse images differently, and then they're aware of completely different things. Now, if we take a standard neural net, a convolutional neural net for recognizing objects, none of those things are true of the standard neural net. It doesn't use intrinsic coordinate frames, at least not explicitly. It doesn't parse images, at least not explicitly. And it doesn't have two completely different ways of seeing exactly the same image. Notice this isn't like a Necker cube where the two different interpretations of a line drawing correspond to different 3D structures. Here, the different parses are the same 3D structure. They have the same truth conditions. They're just different senses in philosophical terms. They're different ways of seeing the same thing. And convolutional nets don't have that. If we want neural nets to work more like people, they better have that. I just said all that. Okay, here's a good old fashioned AI structural description. So I have nodes, I have arcs connecting the nodes. This is for the crown interpretation of those six rods. And the edges, what I put on those edges are the coordinate transformation between the coordinate system you impose on the whole thing, like the crown, and the coordinate system you impose on one of its parts, like the green flap, And if you think about the relation between those two things, there's a transformation of a coordinate system, that's RWX. And that knowledge doesn't change as I change viewpoint. If I bend the rods, that'll change. The relation between the crown and the flap will change. But if I just change my viewpoint, all those things written on the arcs are completely stable across viewpoint. And that's why they're very good ways of describing a shape. They're completely viewpoint independent. Here's the alternative pars I showed you. And here's something else that I call a mental image. It's the underlying structural description, but associated with that structural description in those blue boxes, we've got the viewing transform. That is, for each of the nodes, we know the relationship of the intrinsic frame of reference, so for example, the crown, to the camera or the retina. And that's the relationship to the viewer. And what you'll notice is that if I tell you what's in the top blue box, the RWV, then if you multiply that by RWX, you get RXV. These are all matrices, right? You get the relationship of the flap to the viewer. In other words, if you have a structural description like this, and I give you the viewpoint on one of the nodes, you can propagate that viewpoint information to all the other nodes. That's actually a very useful thing to do. That's what I think a mental image is like. And it's useful because if I were, for example, to ask you, what's the relationship, if you're seeing it this way, between edge A and edge D? Well, they're in different parts. So it's quite a long path in this graph. It's got four matrix multiplies in it. But if you can propagate viewpoint information so that you can actually see it mentally, that is, you've got a viewpoint on everything, then to know how A relates to D, you just need to look at the relationship between RAV and RDV. So you've got it down to a much simpler operation. That's why, that's the conditions under which you use mental imagery. Okay, so what I've said so far all fits in with good old-fashioned AI. We've got a nice structural description. We've imposed some relations to the viewer so we can do certain computations more easily. But it's not really challenging conventional AI. And indeed, this picture was made in 1979, which is sort of the heyday of conventional AI. Now, what I want to talk now is about something that it's taken me like 40 years to figure out, which is how do you get this kind of structural description into a neural network? And the problem is the neural networks don't work like conventional computers. They don't have random access memory. You can't just create data structures and allocate neurons to those data structures. What a neuron does is all tied up with the weights it has. So the weights of a neuron aren't things you can quickly change. So you can't just create a node, okay? But we do need to create a node. So somehow we have to be able to create this node in the pars tree, but it can't be by setting aside a little piece of memory or a group of neurons to act as that node. In a computer, we'd set aside some memory, we'd give that pointers to other bits of memory we set aside for other nodes, and we'd be done. But you can't do that with neurons. So what do you do instead? So you've got to deal with this problem that every image is going to have a different pars tree. And so you've got to dynamically create a representation of these pars trees. You've got to dynamically create something like a pointer, because this is a new thing you've got to represent, and other things have got to know they're connected to the same new thing. But you can't set aside neurons to be nodes in a pars tree. And so that's what this talk's going to answer. It's going to be really quite an obvious way of doing it, but it's not something people have really proposed before. So I'm going to now step back and describe the transformer to you. There's one special thing about transformers, something I've been pushing for a while, which is in standard neural nets, the activity of a neuron depends on the scalar product of the input vector with the weights of that neuron. So you're multiplying together a vector of activities with a vector of weights, and that's what determines whether the neuron gets active. And then there's a nonlinearity. In transformers and in something called capsules, which I've been pushing, think of capsules as a version of transformers that doesn't actually work very well. The idea is that neurons will get active based on a product of scalar product of activity vectors. And that gives you very different abilities. For example, if you can take the scalar product of activity vectors, you can very easily say whether two inputs have the same value or not. So you can solve the XOR problem without needing any hidden units. But that's the fundamental innovation of transformers, to use scalar products of activity vectors. And what I'll do is I'll show you how transformers relate to convolutional neural nets for processing sentences. So suppose we have a string of four words. Nowadays you'd use word fragments, but let's not have that complexity for now. In the neural net world, the first thing you do with a word is convert it to a distributed representation called an embedding, so a vector of activities. I'll call that the word vec. And so four words come in, you convert them to four word vecs. And now the idea is we're going to have a number of layers, and at each layer, we're going to try and refine the word vec. So we're going to make the word vec that initially isn't quite sure what the meaning of the word is. We're going to make it more and more confident about the interpretation of that particular word. So let's suppose the third word in this string of four words was the word may. And let's suppose we'd removed all capitals. So now we don't know whether May is a month, or it's a modal, or maybe it's a woman's name. We just don't know which it is. But let's suppose that the word next to it is June. Well, now it's much less likely to be a modal. It's quite likely to be a month. It might still be a woman's name, but it's most likely to be a month. So the idea of those four heavy black arrows is that you look around at nearby words and they help you revise your word vector to make it less ambiguous and more appropriate to the context. So if the third word came in was May, the initial word vector will be ambiguous between a modal and a month. And after you've seen, I mean, suppose the previous words are Friday the 13th of, then you'd be pretty confident it was May that came next, and you disambiguate it to make it the word vector much more correct for a month than for a modal. So that's how convolutional nets would do it. But notice with the convolutional net, the nearby words are having an influence, but they're all having an influence that's sort of independent of their content. So the word that's the second word is going to have an influence on the reinterpretation of May, the refinement of the embedding vector. But it's not going to depend on what that second word is. Transformers do a much better job of this. So in a transformer, what you're going to do is a word's going to come in and you're going to do something quite complicated. I'm going to make use of transformers later, but a much simpler form of them. The word vector is going to give rise to a key and a query and a value. And in order to revise this word vector, oh, there's a missing black arrow from the word, the vertical black arrow from the word vector to itself at the next time step, says the meaning obviously depends on the input word. But if you look at those three other black arrows, what's happening is they're going to have different strengths depending on the match between the query value of the third word and, for example, the key value, the key of the second word. So if the query and the key match, then the value associated with the second word is going to strongly influence the new embedding of the third word in the sentence. If they don't match, it's not going to have much influence. So the idea is that the third word, which was May, creates this query. The query looks to see which other keys it matches. And if it matches the key of another word, then the other word's allowed to strongly influence with some value vector the new embedding. And you make all these influences sum to one by simply saying that you're going to take the scalar product of the query vector of the third word with, for example, the key vector of the second word, and then you're going to exponentiate that. So if there's a good match, it's going to get a much bigger impact than a poor match. So that's how transformers enable the context to influence how you revise the embedding of a word, but it's only relevant things in the context that influence it, and irrelevant things won't have much effect. That's the general idea of transformers. Now, another aside, I'm going to talk about contrast of learning of representations without labels. So the idea of contrastive self-supervised learning is that the visual system probably extracts a whole bunch of structure from the input data without requiring labels like that's a cat and that's a dog. We have very few of those. And one interesting objective function is to try and reconstruct the input image. And then you develop things called autoencoders. But an alternative objective function, it was slightly motivated by the fact I was once a philosophy student and was forced to read Kant. And Kant went on about space and time. So a slightly different objective function is to say, why don't we try and make the low-level visual input, try and extract properties that are coherent across space or time? And so with Sue Becker in 1992, I published a version of this. It didn't work that well. And it got rediscovered much later. And now this works really well. I'm just going to talk about one version developed at the Google Lab in Toronto. There are many other versions, and these versions are getting better all the time. Every few weeks, someone makes it work better. And it's now, this kind of learning has now got good enough so it can compete with supervised learning with labels. That is, you do unsupervised learning to develop representations. And once you've developed those representations, you then make a simple supervised system that just uses the representations you already decided on and tries to classify things, as opposed to having to tune all the filters using the labels. Here, layers of filters get tuned by this unsupervised objective of making things coherent across space. And I'll describe in a little bit more detail how one of those systems worked. This was primarily developed by Ting Chen in Toronto, with a lot of help from Simon Cornblith. The idea is you take an image X, you then make two different transformations of the same image. And these transformations, the ones that seem to work best are, you take two different crops. So you're looking at different patches, quite possibly overlapping from the same image, but you also mess with the color balance. And then you take these two transformed versions of the same image, you put them through one of the deep neural nets, like a residual net developed for doing object classification. But we're not going to give that net any labels. So that's called F, and that's a big deep neural net. And you're going to get a representation for the first image patch, XJ, XI, and a representation for the second image patch, HJ. So HI is the representation of XI, and HJ is the representation of XJ. Then you're going to do something else. You're going to compress those representations a bit. You're going to project them down, and which I'm not going to dwell on here. And you're going to get two smaller representations called ZI and ZJ. And now your objective function for learning is to maximize the agreement between ZI and ZJ. You want ZI to be very similar to ZJ. And you can do this if you do it in the obvious way of just saying make those vectors similar. What's going to happen is everything's going to collapse. They're always going to be zero for all images. What you really mean is make them agree when I show them two patches of the same image and make them not agree when I show them two patches from different images. And that's why the learning is contrastive. When I show you two patches that came from the same image, you try and make ZI similar to ZJ. If I show you two patches that came from different images, if ZI and ZJ are already very different, don't do anything. But if ZI and ZJ are similar for two patches from different images, then make them more different. And that's what stops it collapsing. And that works very nicely. It develops very nice representations of image patches. I'll leave it at that. And these representations are good because you can then put a simple linear classifier on top and it does really well. Now, contrastive learning has a problem, which is you want to use it for recognizing objects, but suppose one patch of the image contained objects of class A and B and another patch contained objects of class A and C. You really don't want the same representation of those two patches. You really want the first patch to know that part of it should be the same as the representation of the second patch, namely the part that contains object A, but part of it should be different. And so it has to have a lot more say about what it's similar to and what it isn't similar to. And that's just like the difference between the convolutional net and the transformer that I talked about. So we want something much more like transformers for doing this contrastive learning. And my system called GLOM, which is just vaporware, is designed to do that. So GLOM's a way of discovering spatial coherence that's smarter than standard contrastive learning. I should mention a number of other groups have realized quite recently that you need to be more selective about what you contrast with. You need to let things have their own idea of what they ought to be similar to. In particular, a paper by a bunch of authors at Berkeley, one of whom is Efros, uses a technique like this, a very recent paper, to track objects and images much more successfully than before. Okay. So before I talk about the details of GLOM, I want to make some disclaimers. Vision is really a sampling process, human vision, in which you have a sequence of intelligently chosen fixation points. So you don't have to process everything at high resolution. And so you're sampling the optic array. I'm going to ignore that aspect of vision. I'm just going to focus on what happens if you make one fixation and it's your first fixation, so you have no prior expectations of what you're going to see. And by making it the first fixation, I get rid of prior knowledge about this particular scene, and I don't have to worry about the issue of how you decide where to fixate. So I'm ignoring all that aspect of vision. So I mentioned this briefly already. In symbolic AI, what you do to represent a node in a part-whole hierarchy is you set aside some RAM, and give it some pointers and you're done. I had a system called capsules where the idea was, because you can't dynamically allocate neurons, you're going to allocate them ahead of time, and you're going to allocate a bunch of neurons for each possible node in the image, in any image. So most of these groups of neurons aren't going to be used most of the time. And for each image, you'll activate a small subset of the capsules and then dynamically hook them together to represent the parse tree. We got that to work, but it never worked very well for big data sets. In GLOM, we're going to use a third way of representing a part-whole hierarchy, and we're going to use islands of agreement. And you'll see what that means. So there's a biological analogy here. Here's a weird fact about biology that's so familiar that it doesn't seem weird anymore. Every single cell in your body has the instructions for being anything. It has unlimited potential, at least when it starts out. So your brain cells know how to be liver cells, and that seems completely crazy. Now, the actual environment it's in determines which proteins it actually builds, which genes it expresses. So cells differ in their vector of protein expressions, but they have the same knowledge in them. And I want to do the same with capsules now. So old-fashioned capsules, they were about a particular type of part, and they had the knowledge for that particular type of part. But new capsules now have, they're not specific to particular types. Each capsule has to know about everything, which is quite demanding, like every cell in your body. But biology is quite good at dealing with this massive replication because it does things on an atomic scale. So every capsule will now know about everything. It'll be a universal capsule. And this seems very wasteful, but actually we're going to see it's very convenient, and it's actually not really wasteful. You need the computational capacity that provides you with. So we're going to make image locations, and by location, imagine an image, once you foveate it, imagine the image has a few thousand locations. So if you're a neuroscientist, these are like hypercolumns in the visual cortex. The weights in the neural net are like the DNA. And so in all these different columns, We're going to replicate the same knowledge. And that's what we do explicitly in a convolutional net. We duplicate the weights at every location. And the complete vector of neural activities for a given location is like the vector of protein expressions in a cell. So a bunch of cells that have a similar vector of protein expressions form an organ, right? That's what makes an organ. All the cells are expressing roughly the same proteins. This, as you will understand, is a simplification. Similarly, an object is going to be a bunch of locations that have similar activity vectors. Now, of course, within an object, there may be sub-objects like the parts that have similar activity vectors that are different from one another. But overall, the complete activity vector at a location is going to be quite similar for all the parts of an object. So that's the analogy there. And here is the GLOM architecture. I'm just showing you three adjacent levels. And all of this network is for a single location. So for neuroscientists, think hypercolumn. It's actually an architecture for processing video. We're going to apply it to static images, and we're going to treat a static image as a video that's very boring. Nothing's changing, okay? Because your visual system isn't really designed for processing static images. It's designed to deal with video. So in this architecture, frame one comes in. You get a low-level representation, level L minus one representation, at this location of frame one. A time step later, that will have given rise to a representation at level L. And a time step later, that will have given rise to a representation at level L plus one. And those blue arrows are what I call the bottom-up network. And there's at least two hidden layers in each of those blue arrows. So getting from level L minus one to level L is quite complicated. It's going to need to be complicated because it needs to do coordinate transformations. And similarly, from level L to L plus one is quite complicated. This is a recurrent net. So if you look at the three diagonal blue arrows in the sort of bottom row between level L minus one and level L, that's the same network being used again and again. Those weights are the same, right? A vertical time slice here is time. There's also a top-down model. So if you look at L level L plus one, there's a red arrow goes down to level L, and that's happening all the time too, at each time step. You're predicting a level from the level above. So this is a recurrent network. It operates over time. A fixation comes in, and then for multiple time steps, like 10 or 20 time steps of this net, you're settling on an interpretation of that fixation. And the settling involves lower level things activating higher level things, but also higher level things activating lower level things. That's contextual influences. Okay. And if you ask, how do you determine the level L embedding? It's determined by four factors. So if we go back a slide, if I can do that. For if you look at the rightmost level L there, it's getting bottom-up input from the previous time step at level L minus one. It's getting top-down input from the previous time step at level L plus one. It's getting lateral input from itself at the previous time step, that's the green arrow. And it's getting one other thing that's not shown here, which is, this is all for a single location. So this is all going on within one hypercolumn. It's also going to get contextual influences from other locations. And that's where the transformer aspect comes in. The four influences on the embedding at a particular level are the bottom up, the top down, and they're within the same location. There's the previous embedding, but then there's an average of the embeddings at nearby locations. So that's contextual influence. And that's going to be an attention weighted average. You don't just willy-nilly average with the activations at nearby locations. You look to see whether the nearby locations agree with you. And if they agree with you, then you average with them. This is kind of well known in America. This is called an echo chamber. And what you do is you only accept opinions from people who already agree with you. And then what happens is you get an echo chamber where a whole bunch of people have exactly the same opinion. And so Glom actually uses that in a constructive way. So what I'm showing you now are these vertical columns here. They are like the columns. They correspond to sort of hypercolumns, but in different cortical areas. And these are for six adjacent locations. So imagine six locations in a row. So the first location, the leftmost column, the data comes in, you form the lowest level embedding. Now you may well go through a convolutional net and a whole bunch of stuff before you get to that lowest level embedding. And that's that little black arrow that's pointing downwards and to the right. And that's meant to be a vector representation of that embedding. It would actually be an activity in hundreds of units. At the nearby location, things are a bit different in the image. You have a different embedding. Okay, so that's going to be the lowest level in our part whole hierarchy. And everything's different. Now, if you look at the leftmost two columns here, you'll see that at the next level up, they have exactly the same representation. What's happened is the system discovered a little local part. The part spans these two locations. And what it's doing is it's giving exactly the same vector representation to both these locations. As you go up one more level, you can see the first three locations are now apart, and they all have exactly the same vector representation at that level. Of course, those locations have different vector representations at a lower level. If you look at the three green arrows to the right, that's a different part. So the red arrows think of as maybe it's discovered a nose, and the green arrows think of as maybe it's discovered a mouth. At the next level up, all those black arrows are the same because the nose has predicted a face and the mouth has predicted a face, and they predicted the same face, that is a face with the same pose, the same relation to the camera. And so at the next level up, they all agree on what the face is. So you'll notice if you can get this to work, if you can form these little local echo chambers, and the echo chambers get bigger as you go up, then you do have a representation of a parse tree. It's a representation that can represent more than just a parse tree. For example, it has no problem with things like with sentences like, maybe this will slow phrase structure grammarians down. The slow and down can be part of the same structure, even though they're separated by something else, because you can do that with islands. You can have discontinuous islands. So the way the parse tree is represented here is that at the object level, you have this big island. The parts of the object are smaller islands. The subparts are even smaller islands, and so on. So I could take this bunch of vectors, and I could, if I liked, turn it into a tree. I could draw one node for all those black arrows at the top, and then a node for the red arrows and a node for the green arrows, and so on. And that's what I'd do if I wanted to sort of illustrate the parse tree it's found. But this representation in and of itself is perfectly fine. This has all the information you need from parse tree. Every location knows which node it's part of at each level. And parts that are in the same object can talk to each other because they're using the same vector. So if you ask, what happened to the address we would have used in symbolic AI to represent the node? Well, look at that black vector at the top. That's the same for all the parts of an object. That vector is like the address. It's the thing we create. It's a vector of activities. It's not an arbitrary vector like it would be in a computer, so it's not symbolic in that sense. But it is a vector of activities. You are able to judge whether that vector is the same as another vector. That's an important property of a symbol, and you can do that by seeing if these two vectors have a big scalar product. But also, it's able to point to things. So the one bit I haven't shown you is how you get one of those black vectors at the top to point to one of those red vectors at the level below and get the very same black vector to point to one of those green vectors in a different column. So this seems like a bit of a problem. You've got the same representation of the object and it has to point to different parts in different places. And initially you think, well, the same representation can't give rise to two different things, at least not in a deterministic system. And noise isn't going to help us. This is a deterministic thing we want. We want it the black arrow to give us a red arrow in some locations and give us a green arrow in other locations. And that's where implicit functions come in, hopefully. Yeah. So here's a very simple example of an implicit function decoder. Imagine you've got 4 pixels in a row at locations 1, 2, 3, and 4. And imagine these 4 pixels have a gradient of intensities. So the intensity of pixel 1 is f of x1, and that's different from the intensity of pixel 2, f of x2. But suppose, because this is a consistent gradient, we think these 4 pixels are all sort of part of the same surface. And we'd like to give all 4 pixels exactly the same representation. And despite giving them the same representation, we'd like to be able to reconstruct from that representation the activity of a pixel. Well, suppose the pixel intensities are determined by the function f, where f of x equals ax plus b. What you need to do is give each pixel a representation that's just the coefficients in that equation. You give each pixel a representation ab. So they've all got the same representation vector, but they don't all reconstruct the same thing. The decoder gets to see the pixel representation, AB, but it also gets to see the pixel location, X1. And the decoder puts together the AB with the X1 and gives you the appropriate intensity. So the decoder just has to implement that little function, F of X equals AX plus B. Okay, so hopefully you get the idea that things can have the same representation and they can give rise to different things in different places, provided the decoder is told about the place. So let's go back. Let's suppose that that black arrow at the top is representing a particular instance of a face. So it knows all sorts of things about the deformation of the face, but in particular, it knows the pose of the face, that is the relation of the face to the camera. The relation between the face, intrinsic coordinate frame of the face and the intrinsic coordinate frame of the camera. So now if you take the first column on the left, where the black arrow has to give rise to a red arrow, if that's a face, let's suppose the red arrow is the nose, right? So what you have to do is take the face vector, take the image location of the column you're in, that is, where are we in the image? The face vector contains the relationship, the 3D relationship between the intrinsic coordinate frame of the face and the intrinsic coordinate frame of the image. And so if you know a particular place in the image, a 2D location in the image, let's say a 3D location in the image for now, let's deal with space, not just images. You know how the face is related to the image. You can take the location you're interested in and figure out where that location is in the coordinate frame of the face, okay? So we know it's one of the nose locations, and that'll be at a place within the coordinate frame of the face where you should find noses. If you look to the right, that black vector, it'll be the same face vector, but you're asking the question now, for this other location, what should I find? And this other location will be in the right place relative to the coordinate frame of the face to be a mouth. So now you'll expect to find a mouth there. So the top-down network can take the black arrow and can produce a prediction for a mouth in the column on the right and a prediction for a nose in the column on the left. Now to do all that, it has to be able to do these coordinate transforms. And so that top-down network has to be able to cope with coordinate transforms, which may not sound that difficult. It's not that difficult in graphics, they're just matrix multiplies. But in perception for the bottom-up network, they're quite complicated because of uncertainty. So dealing with probability distributions across coordinate transforms is much trickier. I'm about to put a paper on archive that explains how neural networks can deal with probability distribution across coordinate transforms, but that's what the bottom-up net has to do. Okay, let me. So that's implicit functions, and that's my third big advance. This is revolutionizing computer graphics at present. It gives you the ability to have high quality computer graphics that actually learns. And so all that stuff with triangles and meshes and all that stuff, it's going out the window in favor of implicit functions. Okay, I just talked you through that with the little island example. You have to do this coordinate transforms to know where a location is in the intrinsic frame of reference of the whole thing, and then you can say which part ought to be expressed there. It's a bit like within a kidney, a cell has to know which bit of the kidney it is to know which sort of piece of kidney to express. Okay. So how do we form these islands? And the idea is the contextual influence as level L is settling down in this iterative process is that it's trying to be similar to the embedding vectors at the same level at nearby locations, but it's trying to be similar only to similar embedding vectors. So in transformers, you took an embedding, you converted it to a key and a query and a value. Here, we take the embedding and we don't convert it to anything, we just use the embedding. And you look at the level L embedding vector at location X, that's what I call LX. You take its scalar product with the embedding vector at a nearby location, LY, and you weight those scalar products for all the various things in your context and normalize them. So the sum of the effects of all the things in the context is one. And so now you're going to pay a lot of attention to very similar embedding vectors and very little attention to very different embedding vectors. And that's how you decide your contextual influence. And if you do that, then these at these levels, you get over locations, you get these echo chambers, and it will settle down to islands. And I should stress, this system is just, I have all sorts of intuitions about the engineering of things like this and about how to make these things work. And I find it easier to express my intuitions by having an imaginary system and telling you how the imaginary system works. Hopefully the fact I've actually made some things work in the past will make you at least tend to believe I'm not just doing philosophy here. I do actually believe this can be engineered to work, and things like it already work. Now, if you ask, how do you train this thing? The obvious way to train it is with deep end-to-end training. So what you'd do is you'd take an image, you'd remove some patches from it. So you'd mask out whole patches. You'd let this network settle down. You fixate a point in the image. You'd let the network settle down. And at the end of settling, it would have to have filled in those removed points. That's how BERT trains. You remove some words from the input sentence. And after it's gone through all these layers of embedding, with the embeddings getting more and more refined, it then has to reconstruct the missing words. So you can do the same thing here. You can let this network settle down, and then at the end, it has to fill in missing pieces. And if it gets them wrong, you backpropagate through the whole settling process to train everything. That's the easy way to train it. I don't think that's how brains train, but for now, that'll do for this technology. And the extra term that makes it different from BERT and different from standard transformers in the way you train it is, in addition to training it to be able to fill in image patches, you actually put a regularizer to encourage these islands of agreement. And the regularizer is quite simple. It's just like the regularizer in contrastive learning. Let me go back to the island picture, this picture. So these are different locations now. And if you consider the black arrows at the top, these locations are talking to each other and you'd like them to agree. So what's going to happen is I'm going to go back some more now. Yeah. Let's take the rightmost level L here. That level L is getting three influences from within the same location, namely the bottom-up net, the supplying a coordinate transform to what's at level L minus one and making a prediction for the larger thing you should find at level L. The top-down net, the red arrow, that's supplying a coordinate transform to whatever is at level L plus one and making a prediction, say, from a face to a mouth. And then from other locations, you're getting a prediction from these other locations, that's a contextual prediction of what you want to find there to agree with other nearby locations. And so the way you can train that blue arrow and that red arrow, the bottom up and top down neural nets, is to say, okay, they make a prediction, they each make a prediction, but we have something that's a better opinion than their individual predictions. It's the consensus of what was happening at the previous time step, what the top down says, what the bottom up says, and what the neighboring locations say. You take the consensus opinion from all four sources of information, and you treat that as a supervision signal. You say, when I combine all these sources of information, I get something I believe more than any one source, and so I can use that to train the individual sources. It's very Bayesian. In Bayesian, what you do is you have a prior and you have a likelihood. You combine the prior and the likelihood to get a posterior, and then you train your prior to be more like your posterior. You say the combined thing is a better bet than the individual things, so I'm going to train my prior to match my posterior. And here what you're going to do is you're going to train that top-down red model and bottom-up blue model to be a closer fit to the posterior you get when you take both those models into account and also neighboring locations. And when you do that training, you're going to be encouraging neighboring locations to agree. And so that regularizer is going to encourage you to form islands. I'm almost done. Just did that. And I want to, the final thing I want to address is, isn't it terribly wasteful to replicate all these object level vectors at all these different locations? Because the intuitions you get from programming a computer with RAM is that if you've got the same thing, you want to represent it in one place and have pointers to it. You don't want to replicate it all over the place. That, notice that's not what biology does. Biology is quite happy to replicate if it's convenient. And the reason this replication is very convenient is after you've settled down on objects, of course, all those vectors are the same and you could have represented it with one thing. But if you're in the process of segmenting the image, you haven't quite decided which echo chamber you want to join, you want to be able to have ambiguous representations to say, well, I'm sort of like this and I'm sort of like that. And for the time being, I'll say I'm like both of them and see how things work out. I'll try and be like both of them. And so during the search for how to segment the image, how to form the parse tree, it's very helpful to have these highly redundant representations where at every location, you're going to have a bet about which object you're part of, and that's going to be a whole vector, but also a bet about which part you're part of and a bet about which subpart you're part of. And all these things are going to be interacting. There's bottom-up and top-down effects making these vectors at a location all interact with each other. And it's not like finding a cluster or something because the data itself is changing. In cluster finding, I give you some data points and you have to find the clusters. Here what's happening is you're trying to find clusters, these islands, but the clusters are composed of things that keep changing. So the normal idea of let's have some means and let's move the means around to try and fit the data doesn't work here because the data itself is evolving in complicated ways. And so a much better way to find these clusters is at each location to have a vector and let those vectors sort of argue with each other and finally agree to disagree, so you get these different echo chambers, but within an echo chamber, you agree with people. And so I think this is going to be a much better way of finding clusters in data that's changing than, for example, the EM algorithm for mixture Gaussians. Now, the other thing this does for you is you'd like long-range interactions within an image, but you don't want too much computation. So already in transformers, what people do is if they want long-range interactions, they make them very sparse, which means they're missing out on a lot, right? They're not looking at a lot of things at long range, they're just sampling. But that's fine here because you can have short-range interactions at low levels where parts are small, and at higher levels where you get big islands, you can afford to have sparse long-range interactions, particularly if they're different on each iteration. Because the long-range interactions only need to sample one point in an island to get all the information about that thing. Each of these embedding vectors at the object level contains all the information about that face, you know, its expression, its pose, who it is, all that kind of stuff. is in every vector. And so you just need to sample one of them, and so you can have sparsity. And this sparsity allows you to have long range interactions without swamping the computation. So in summary, I explained three important advances in neural nets: transformers, SimClear, and implicit functions. I showed how you could combine those into an iterative net that settles down to produce a multi-level representation of what's going on at each image patch. And this solves the problem of how you get parse trees into neural nets. Now, as far as I know, I'm the only person working on this problem. Nobody else seems to be interested because they're either neuroscientists who aren't, well, I'll leave it at that. Nobody else has really been worried by the problem that you can't allocate neurons, and therefore how the hell do you represent parse trees? What I said is very complicated, but there's going to be a long rambling 40-page paper on archive quite soon. And now I think I'm done. Yeah. Okay, I'm done.
Well, thank you very much. Great talk. And I said, what I really love is, as you said, it the idea is very intuitive once you grasp it. So I hope that now many people will be interested in pursuing this topic of representing whole part trees. Okay, so what's going to happen now is we have time until 12:30 for a question and answering from everyone, the general audience. Reminding people from National Science Foundation that at 3 o'clock we have an office hour just for our program officers. So type into the question and answering QA box and use the thumbs up to upvote questions. And I'll begin with our most popular question. Why should we aim for human perception when humans have clear deficiencies, such as in very sparse and long-range dependencies, like those seen in genetics and epigenetics, but more generally, of course, humans fall prey to all kinds of optical illusions. So is the motivation here simply to understand the human system, or is it also that it could improve a practical computer vision?
Okay, so my primary motivation is to figure out how the brain works. I haven't done very well at that so far, but there's been a side effect of trying to do that, which is various engineering suggestions come out of attempts to figure out how the brain works. And it turns out some of those engineering suggestions have been rather successful. So I'm really a fake. I want to figure out how the brain works. I in my spare time, I pretend to be an engineer because that's the way to earn an income while you figure out how the brain works. And so that's my motivations, right? I mean, it could be worse. In the Middle Ages, if you wanted to do research, you had to be a monk. Now you just have to pretend to be an engineer. So that's my motivation. But let me give you a very good reason for trying to figure out how to make neural nets be more like people. You don't want to be surprised by what they do. So adversarial images are really amazing. They're really surprising. I can take an image of a panda. I can change the pixels imperceptibly, and my convolutional neural net will be convinced it's an ostrich. In fact, I can probably take an image of a stop sign and convince the neural net it's a picture of an ostrich too. So that's very surprising. And it's a strong indication that whatever convolutional nets are doing, it's not what we're doing. That is, there's big differences. Maybe they're doing some of what we're doing, and maybe somehow they're dealing with coordinate transforms implicitly. But a lot of what they're doing is very sophisticated texture discriminations, much more sophisticated than us. And you can mess up these texture discriminations with these adversarial examples. If they were working more like us, they couldn't possibly take something that looks just like a panda to us and see it as an ostrich. And so adversarial examples should give you a very strong reason for wanting to make them work more like people. We'd like to be able to trust them a bit more. And if they work more like people, at least they're going to go wrong the same ways as people do. So we'll get some insight into what might confuse them. Until they work a bit more like people, you're going to have no clue what might confuse them unless you do really extensive testing. And even with really extensive testing, there's going to be these weird cases like an overturned white truck on the highway, which just looks like sky to the Tesla. And yeah, so that's, I mean, that's my honest motivation. I want to know how the brain works. And the actual practical motivation is you want to be able to trust them.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I think that this is the big fear with the people who are pursuing end-to-end deep learning for autonomous vehicles with just the standard multi-layer, right, that they fall victim so easily to optical illusions. We can that humans, we might be able to put up with the kinds of optical illusions that humans suffer from.
I mean,
but the ones seem really disastrous.
If Tesla got the same optical illusions as I get, I'd be much more confident that it was seeing things the same way as me.
Just a quick question. What does GLOM stand for? Or is it just
GLOM?
Glom.
Well, there's a word called agglomerate, right?
Oh, okay.
It means sticking things together. And there's a popular slang in English, which is glom together. So what you're trying to do as you go up through these levels is glom things together.
Yes. Okay.
Now, some people have said it might stand for Jeff's last original model. But I don't like that because that looks silly to me. And looks silly to me as LSTM.
Okay. There was a question down the list I think brings up an interesting issue where it said, on Halloween, I wear a mask with two noses. And in general, people can adapt very quickly to novel things that sort of break our high-level expectations. It might take us a minute, but then we can adapt. So could you say something about how GLOM handles the novel objects?
Yes. So now remember that this is like talking about characters in a novel. GLOM doesn't actually exist. So we're talking, you know, counterfactuals about characters in a novel are philosophically problematic. And how GLOM handles such things is philosophically problematic. Nevertheless, I have proposals for it. So there's one issue is what I call fast weights. So in neural nets, we have two timescales typically. You have the activity timescale, where things change rapidly in an image. And then you have the weights, where for a given image, nothing changes. They evolve slowly with learning. You obviously want to have things that I call fast weights, a third timescale, which is weights that adapt rapidly. They're going to be very useful for things like short-term memory, working memory. So for example, if you want to implement a truly recursive function in a neural network, what it would mean to have a truly recursive function in a neural net is that since the knowledge is in the connections, you get to reuse the same neurons and the same connections for the recursive call. So let's suppose that painted on your nose, I have a face, right? So I look at your face and in very small detail, actually, this isn't so unrealistic. Reflected in your glasses, I have a face. So I look at your face, and then I look at this detail, and that's a face. So I've got this recursive call now, and I want to use the very same knowledge. So I better use the same neurons, because that's where the knowledge is. And if I'm going to do that, I have to be able to then pop back to the whole face. So I have to be able to do the take things off the stack again that I put on the stack. And where is that stack? Well, in neural nets, you can implement that with fast weights. That is, you have a temporary overlay to the weights that allows you to do fast associative retrieval of things you had recently. And actually, that was the very first neural net model I made. It was the first talk I ever gave in 1973 about how to do recursive neural nets with fast weights. And it's just coming back into fashion. And I'm going to wait another year before I re-implement it. And then it'll be 50 years since I first did it. But fast weights is the answer.
That's fascinating. And I said, I'll look forward. Maybe just have a quick follow-up. So sort of a two-part question. So is there biological evidence of some implementation of fast weights? And then how do the fast weights get turned into long-term memory? We know that in the brain, it involves something involving the hippocampus and sleep and all kinds of things.
Right. Oh, yeah. There's all kinds of things. So come back to sleep in a minute. But if you talk to neuroscientists about where temporary memories are, Well, the neuroscientist I talked to, in fact, the very first time I talked to Sergei Sinofsky, he was concerned to educate me that there isn't just one time scale of synaptic changes. He was working on frogs at Harvard then. He said there's very fast synaptic changes and much slower synaptic changes, and your models really ought to contain both things. You shouldn't just have one time scale. So yes, there's lots of neural evidence. I talked to Simon Kornblith, who did a PhD in neuroscience at MIT recently. And if you look for where memory is for things that are a minute old, you could have a bunch of neurons just sitting around going ping, 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 I'm remembering stuff that's a minute old. Or you could temporarily adapt synapses, and it seems far more likely there's temporary adaptations of synapses. So for example, if I say the word sleep now, you'll recognize you said something about sleep like 30 seconds ago. Where is that stored? Where is that knowledge that you mentioned sleep 30 seconds ago? Do you really have vectors of neural activity sitting around remembering that? Or did you just temporarily change the synapse strengths involved in the word sleep and its associations so that now if I hear the word sleep in noise 30 seconds later, I'll be better at recognizing it? And it seems much more likely it's temporary weight changes. So the essential answer is temporary weight changes.
Mm-hmm. Great. Another question, I think from people who think a lot about medical imaging, so the examples you use for part whole, where it's like face, where there's like the eyes are here and the nose is down below. So in medical world, people are often looking at like images of a cluster of cells, and they're trying to figure out some of these cells are cancerous and others not, but they don't have that same kind of geometric distribution. Does that also still fit within this part whole hierarchy?
Well, I think it's going to be the case. I'm not an expert on medical images. I've been quoted as saying we need to get rid of radiologists because computers are going to do better. And I still believe that. But for example, if I look at a bunch of cells in a pathology slide, I might expect to find a bunch of cancer cells next to one another. I think they tend to replicate. In fact, that's what they tend to do rather well. And therefore, you tend to get a bunch nearby each other. So that certainly fits with the island idea. You certainly expect to be able to segment it into similar things being near one another. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. And again, because we have a general audience there, we have some career-related questions. And maybe I'll just summarize that. I've heard you give advice at other lectures. So let's say someone is listening to this talk and is an undergraduate, or maybe they've been working for a few years, and they say, "Oh, this sounds great." What should their next steps be? Graduate programs in AI and in neuroscience. What do you recommend people do?
I have some standard advice I give, which is about trusting your intuitions, which doesn't exactly answer this question, but I'll be politician-like and answer a different question that I prefer to answer.
Okay.
So sort of how should I organize my career if I want to do this kind of stuff? And my answer is you should trust your intuitions. And in particular, you should focus on where you have a strong intuition that everybody's doing it wrong, and you don't know how to do it right yet, but there's something fishy about what everybody's doing. And this talk's a nice example. There's something fishy about allocating some hardware to represent a node in a parse tree. Notice that what the brain does is not that. The brain allocates hardware to locations, and then it allocates a vector to represent the nodes in a parse tree. And that's an activity vector, and that's easy to allocate. You can create those on the fly. So really, trust your intuitions when you think what everybody else is saying is fishy and focus on that. And it's taken me like 40 years to figure out how to make this work. But just keep focusing on that. And the motivation for that is that either you've got good intuitions or you don't. If you've got good intuitions, you should trust them. If you don't have good intuitions, it doesn't really matter what you do. So you might as well focus on your intuitions.
I guess Well, and of course, there's always the issue of not everyone starts out with a lot of great intuition. So one has to be prepared for a lot.
Okay, so now I'll answer the question.
And it also helps to have an advisor who can encourage, you know, can help draw out your intuitions.
So now I'll actually answer the question. What you should do is you should get yourself a good background in linear algebra and probability theory and computer science and everything else, neuroscience, all those things. And then you should get yourself into a graduate school at a really good place where you'll have an advisor who's smart, but more importantly, you'll have other grad students who are smart to talk to. And it's that sort of incubator of other smart grad students in an environment where if they come up with stuff that's already known, someone will tell them, yeah, that's already been done. So obviously you should do all that. But all of it's a waste of time unless you have strong intuitions of your own and you trust them.
That's great. Let's see, we just have some more questions here. So contemporary language models such as BERT and GPT-3 require enormous amounts of data and computation. And so they're very hard to replicate, you know, unless you're an enormous company. Is the same thing going to apply to GLOM? And my intuition, let's see if that's correct, is that when you're looking at sort of a radically new approach, often you can explore that at a smaller scale, and you don't necessarily need to learn a trillion node system. But what's your answer?
My answer is, I think it's quite similar in physics. There's some physics you can do on a small scale. For example, the two slits experiment that proved that quantum mechanics is sort of right and one photon goes through both slits. That doesn't require fancy apparatus. Discovering the Higgs boson requires billions and billions of dollars of fancy apparatus and huge teams. So there's some things you can do on a small scale and some things you can't. I believe that the biggest advances are going to come, well, a lot of the biggest advances are still going to come from things you can do on a small scale. And I only do small scale stuff myself. But I also believe there's things that can only be explored on a big scale. So I sit on the fence. I believe in doing small scale scientific stuff to try and understand new ideas and solve sort of basic problems that haven't been solved yet. But I also believe that we learn a lot from these huge experiments. We learn a lot from the fact that when you go from a billion parameters to a trillion parameters, things still keep getting better. And I don't have much patience for saying, well, you shouldn't be allowed to publish those papers because we can't replicate that in my computer science department because we can't use kind of, you know, a million years of CPU time to replicate this experiment. They don't say you shouldn't publish papers on the Higgs boson because we don't have a CERN in our backyard. And I think you need to think of these two kinds of things. And so there's some things that only the big companies are going to be able to do, places like OpenAI and DeepMind and Facebook and so on. Luckily, there's a bunch of them. So it's not, I mean, they can check each other. But we have to be open to that kind of research. And we have to be willing to publish that kind of research, even though it can't be replicated by people in a typical computer science department. But I think we're going to get even bigger wins from small scale research done in universities where you're exploring a bigger diversity of ideas.
Okay. I have a question, kind of a modification of one of the questions here about the implications. Let's say that Blom is right. And now you're a neuroscientist. What should you be looking for in the brain that might that would help confirm the GLOM approach?
Okay, I'm actually correct. Working on two papers. One I'm going to put on archive in a week or two. That's the GLOM paper. And then there's another paper that's still got a bit more work to be done. And I'm going to leave it till that second paper. That second paper is going to make a lot of predictions about what neuroscientists should find.
Excellent. Let's see.
But I can say one thing. I can say one thing that might be interesting to neuroscientists. So at present, if you look at the theories of sleep, the standard neural net theory of sleep at present is that you drive things top down from the hippocampus, and it allows you to do rehearsal. So you get sort of more, you can rehearse on data you got during the day. It also allows you to integrate data you got during the day with older data so that they all fit in the same model. So you're not overwriting your old experience with new experience because you're making sure both of them work. And that's one theory of sleep, but it's not very satisfactory. And the reason it's not satisfactory is if I deprive you of sleep for a few days, you go psychotic. If I just deprive you of sleep for a week, completely deprive you of sleep for a week, you go so psychotic, you might never recover. I think the CIA did these experiments, probably in Canada. And so why is sleep so utterly devastating? Well, here's a theory Terry Sinoski and I cooked up recently. You're doing this contrastive learning where you want two patches in the same image to have the same representation. And you want two patches in different images to have different representations. And so contrastive learning involves a positive phase where things that should be the same are made the same, and a negative phase, which is sort of like a partition function, where things that should be different are kept different. Things that shouldn't be confused are kept different. And it seems very hard to run both those phases at once in a video pipeline when the data is coming in. It's clear that when data is coming in, you could actually be making things that should be the same more similar. That is, you could be at each level, you could get the contextual predictions and the bottom-up and top-down prediction, and you can make the top-down and bottom-up predictions agree more with the contextual predictions and vice versa. So you could be doing that positive phase while you're awake. But what about the negative phase of making things that should be different? Well, for actually doing contrastive learning on video, we know something, which is the very best negative examples are ones from the same video that aren't the adjacent frames, but are a few frames away. So you can imagine a window of video, and contrastive learning there says, make your representation of this frame be very similar to the representations of neighboring frames and dissimilar from the representations of frames that are a bit further away. Because those are the ones you'd obviously get confused by. And that way you'll force yourself to get temporally smooth representations that capture temporal invariance, local temporal invariance. So how would you do that in a brain? And here's a way you could do it in a brain. You could say during the day, you just make things more similar. You don't worry about holding them apart. So during the day, your representations are going to slowly collapse towards each other. Now, you go to sleep and you look for things that have now become too similar and should be different. And the way you do that is you'd create a video and you'd look at things further away. If you've got a particular window in which you do this learning of making things similar or dissimilar, you could look for things further away by just playing the video faster. So in sleep, what you might do is recreate a video, but make it go, for example, about seven times as fast. Now you can do that with GLOM because you've got this top-down model, and the top-down model doesn't require any attention. Attention to neighboring things is required for contextual disambiguation because you've got uncertainty. When you're generating, there's no uncertainty. So you can generate top-down very fast. So from the top level, I run my video rapidly. From that, I generate all the other levels, okay? And I generate at high speed, and then I do unlearning. I do the opposite of learning, just the opposite of what I did during the day. And it's taking these hard negative examples, which are frames a bit further away now, which have been moved into the window by playing the video fast. And now I'm unlearning on those. So if you decided to try and make GLOM compatible with biology by doing the unlearning when you're asleep, there's two big questions. The first big question is, will it tolerate having lots of positive learning followed by lots of negative learning? And the answer is yes. Unlike other algorithms, it's very tolerant of that. You can do a lot of positive learning, things start collapsing, but they can collapse a lot before there's significant deterioration. then you can do a lot of negative learning and unclaps the things that have got too close. And you can do a lot of negative learning. So it's capable of dealing with a day's worth of learning followed by a night's worth of unlearning. And then the second question is there any evidence at all for this kind of thing? And the answer is, when you first go to sleep, you have a phase of sleep where the spindles, and what sleep spindles are, is you're replaying the day's experience or experiences like the day seven times as fast. They see this in rats. Rats do it during sleep. They also do it after they've been through a maze, they do a spindle phase. And the way you tell it is in rats, you have place fields for where they've been, and you can record from these place fields, so you can follow a trajectory. And during sleep, they do the same trajectories, but seven times as fast. Now, they also may replay things backwards, and that's another story. That's also very interesting. But there is some evidence that the spindle phase of sleep is for replaying things very fast. And for contrastive learning, that would really fit in with doing the unlearning. And now that would explain why lack of that phase of sleep causes psychosis. Your representations collapse and that you get totally confused.
Wow. Well, thank you. That's a great, boy, your answer to the question, it was like, worth
a bit more detail than you expected.
But no, but it's wonderful because it's like it's like a whole, in my notes here, it's a whole nother talk, and I'll certainly look forward to that. I can put in a plug for a book that actually addresses some issues with sleep, Walker's book, Why We Sleep, a popular account of sleep science. But he concentrates a lot mostly on the sort of the unconscious phases of sleep that involve a lot of cleanup of toxins and so forth, which probably also contribute as well.
I'm sure sleep does lots of other things, right?
Yes, but I wasn't aware of that spindle. That kind of also explains the why, you know, why it seems like I was dreaming for hours, but, you know, only a few minutes really passed in real time. We're going to have to draw to a close there, unless you'd like to say, my last question was going to be to ask you to talk more about Kant, but if...
talk more about what? Sorry.
You mentioned the influence of Kant's critique of pure reason and theory of time and space. So if you want to take 2 minutes to go into more explanation of how that influenced your thinking.
There was something that always intrigued me in that, which is, he said something like, and you understand, this is just amateur philosophy. Space is the form of the external sense and time is the form of the internal sense. And that just intrigued me when I read it as a philosophy student. And it led to me thinking more about objective functions for learning. And in particular, this idea that spatial coherence is a different objective function from autoencoding, but also temporal coherence.
Okay, great. Okay, well, thank you so much. Thank our audience, thank our tech crew, and given us a lot to think about. You know, as at NSF, we are also always thinking about our research portfolio and what areas we should be doing more to promote. And I think you've given us a lot of ideas.
Can I make one comment about funding? I think I've earned the right to make one comment.
Oh, absolutely. Funding. Yes, yes.
If you look at the deep learning revolution, a lot of it came from me and Yoshua Bengio in Canada.
Yep.
And we weren't supported by big grants. We were supported by big grants for Canada, you know, the order of $100,000 a year for a whole lab. Mm-hmm. But they were completely unrestricted. That is, every 5 years you write a proposal and it's 6 pages and you say what you plan to do and nobody holds you to it. And that kind of support for basic research is really, really valuable in the very long run. It's very hard to sell to politicians. we're just funding these scientists to do whatever they think's cute, doesn't sound like a good funding proposal as opposed to curing cancer. But the really big payoffs come from that. And Canada has a very good program there. It's one, it doesn't have much money for research. It doesn't put nearly enough money in. But one thing it does right is these basic curiosity-driven research grants that go to a wide range of people, because you can't pick winners in advance. You can give them to smart people. You can use peer review to say, is this person worth funding? But you need to distribute it fairly broadly, as opposed to putting, like, the opposite of this would be the European Blue Brain Project or whatever it's called, where you put $1 billion into some crazy idea of simulating a piece of cortex where you can explain all the experimental results. That's a waste of $1 billion.
Well, so, well, let's definitely talk about this when we're in the NSF session this afternoon. But thank you again, and thank you to the audience and to everyone else. Very exciting morning. Take care, everyone.
Okay. Bye.